I've never done this before, and I'm really hoping it works.
I haven't either.
Okay. Neither have I.
If worst comes to worst, if worst comes to worst, we're having a fun time.
Yeah, right. So.
Exactly. Without margaritas, unfortunately. But,
too early.
That's okay. Yeah. David, I've been a fan of this piece. I first heard it a few years ago at Bowling Green State University. I know the Quince Ensemble did it there, the original version. We should mention, we're talking about a new release from the Lorelei Ensemble of Love Fail, a piece of yours you wrote in 2012 for the Anonymous Four Ensemble. It's like a 60-minute sort of exploration or meditation on love. I mean, the title kind of gives you a clue as to what it's about. But this is inspired by the story of Tristan and Isolde. I wonder if you can give us a little overview of the piece itself.
Well, yeah, the first thing is that, you know, Tristan is something that music nerds think about all the time, because we have this incredible opera by Wagner, Tristan and Isolde. And so for composers, we talk about it as being kind of like the high water mark of all the great things that you can do harmonically. You study it in school and you are completely mystified how it can be so perfect and so magical. And the piece, of course, is really beautiful and dramatic. And I, of course, I love this music. I love this piece. And every time I see it, I go, well, yeah, okay, that's like a completely, you know, noble and miserable relationship. And you know something, every relationship which has love in it is also a beautiful and a tragic story as well, because we get to see their whole arc, you know, the whole beginning of the relationship and the end of the relationship and their death. And that's something that we have in our lives, you know. So every time I see it, I'm always struck by the difference between there's that mythic story of love and there's the love that we all experience in our life. And why isn't that as noble? Why isn't that something where we can have an opera that lasts, you know, the length of our entire lives, that, you know, kind of ennobles that in ourselves? So the difference between the mythological and the real is something that always strikes me when I see that piece. And I decided I wanted to make a piece of music on my own about it.
Yeah. I want to introduce Beth here. Beth Willer is artistic director and conductor of the Lorelei Ensemble. So this is an expanded version for women's voices. Beth, first of all, hello. Are you there?
Yes, hello. Thank you for having us.
So tell us a little bit about your collaboration with David Lang. I mean, you've worked with him before, right? And who had the idea to adapt this piece for your ensemble?
Yeah, well, Lorelei, actually, our very first album featured an amount of David's music, and David and I had not yet met, but I think the group has had an affinity for performing his music for quite some time. And it was not too long after the release of our Live No Love album that David contacted me and I think was pleased with the way that we were singing his music, and said he, you know, he was thinking about perhaps expanding this piece that he had already written for Anonymous Four, which of course is a group that Lorelei knows and follows very much in the tradition of music for treble voices and women's voices. And so we were very excited. I was very excited to think about, you know, premiering this new version. And we premiered it in 2016 at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. And it was just a really wonderful experience. My first time actually performing an extended work of David's, which, you know, for anyone that's performed minimalism, it's one thing to perform a short work of 3 to 5 minutes. It's a very different experience. And I would say an entrancing one to lose yourself in a minimalist piece for, you know, any length of time, in this case a little over an hour, and you can't not hear the text, you can't not be pulled in and pulled out of your own pulled into the music and pulled out of, you know, your own mind in many ways. But I would also say, you know, this piece, as David mentioned, the Lydia Davis feels very much like it could be your own story, your own words. And so it's a beautiful piece to perform, and I think was really transformative for us that very first time.
She knows she is right, but to say she is right is wrong.
certain cases. Well, you mentioned Lydia Davis, who is a living writer, and she wrote these texts that David used. And also there are these medieval texts, sort of the, you know, the prototypical Tristan story texts. David, maybe you can talk about how you juxtaposed these together and why you went, how you came up with the idea of taking the ancient and putting in the contents of the modern through these Lydia Davis texts.
Part of the ancient versus modern thing came from working with Anonymous 4, because I thought, here are these people who've dedicated their lives to ancient music, and yet we are modern people. So there's some friction between then and now in everything that they do, and I thought I wanted to keep that in this piece. I started with the Wagner, and I just thought I'm going to go back to all of his sources. And as I read all of his sources, of course, you know, the original story was an oral tradition, and so it got written down by lots of different people at different times and different places. And every one of those different writings had a little detail that was different, or some, you know, different way of looking at it, or some way of explaining it which was unique to it. And so none of the stories really agree on things. You know, there's sort of basic shape of what it is. You know, these people are in love, it ends tragically, but, you know, all the details are different in each one. And I started thinking that it might be interesting to just highlight the differences in each of these, to go back to this and go, you know, in this one version, here's this weird thing that happens, and it only happens in this version. So what I did is I found these moments from the story. I'm not trying to tell the whole story. I'm just going, here's a little moment from their relationship. And then because it was just a moment in a relationship, it reminded me of these beautiful stories by Lydia Davis, who's an amazing American writer. And her stories are very short, and they're all about the same kind of attention to detail. This, here's one moment in a relationship. And when I went back to look at these stories of hers, you know, they're about a man and a woman who are married, or, you know, two people who are married, and they have a long relationship, and they're only referred to as he and she. And then I thought, okay, well, that gives me the key to how to unlock this thing. I'm not going to make it about Tristan and Isolde. I'm going to make it just about a person named he and a woman named she. And it just describes their relationship, right? So then I can use that anonymity to go back and forth in time.
Well, let's talk about the very first song, because that addresses what you're talking about. It, you know, it's 8 minutes of adjectives, basically, in the context of he was this, she was that. All these different things that are, you know, all wonderful attributes, but you present it in kind of sad music. There's a sense of weight to the piece, you know, right from the very beginning. And I assume that was your intent.
Well, when you go see the opera, Tristan and Isolde, you know, at the beginning, it doesn't end well. So you hear the famous music at the beginning, the famous, you know, prelude, and you hear it struggling to become beautiful. And underneath it, you know, okay, it's not going to work out. So part of the knowledge of the piece, and part of the tragedy of this piece, and part of the tragedy of our lives, if we want to get, you know, philosophical about it, is, you know, we know that they don't end well. So the issue is how you deal with things that are present, knowing that eventually things are, you know, all going to fall apart. And so what I did at the beginning is I went to the very first thing that I looked at was the Gottfried von Strasberg, which is one of the major sources for Wagner. And I just thought, who were these people? I have to introduce them, right? So I just went through and I just went, what are the first descriptions that we have of each of these characters? What are the first adjectives? So these are all the adjectives that are in this 13th century description of these people, of the man and the woman, in the order in which they appear in the book. So this is how we meet them in Gottfried von Strasberg. And I thought, if it's good enough for him, it's good enough for us.
She was so sad.
Let me ask you a question while I think about it before I turn it back to Beth for a minute. She mentioned that you were inspired to write for them because you heard them, you liked their performance of your work. Is it a common thing for you to write for specific performers? Are you inspired by musicians?
I love writing for specific people. I love to know who they are. And partly that's because I want to have a friendship with the people who do my work. You know, if somebody is good and they seem like they're nice, I want to actually know them well enough so that I can have a cup of coffee with them and, you know, spend more time with them. But also, especially when you're working with singers, you know, we think that singers are sopranos and altos and basses and tenors, whatever, you know, and that they're interchangeable. But actually, because singing is so personal, because a singer is a person standing there singing to you, all singers are individuals. All singers are different. I don't really believe in voice types at all. I believe in people. And so when I heard this recording, I thought, oh, these people are really great and they have a great relationship with each other and you can hear it in the way they perform. And I wanted to figure out a way to become closer to this great group that already had done a really good job with my music. So I proposed expanding this, you know, piece for them. And I have to say, I'm really happy I did.
We're all happy you did. Beth, we've been talking about the singers. So let's hear from you. Tell us a little bit about Lorelei Ensemble. As I understand it, listening to some of your previous interviews, you were not necessarily a fan of the women's choir leading up to the time that you created your own. Can you sort of tell us the backstory on that?
Well, I wouldn't say there's nobody or no group that I think is fantastic that preceded us, because I think there has been some great you know, music for women's voices and ensembles doing that work. But I think there definitely has been a lack of attention on an ensemble like Lorelei, and just paid to the repertoire that a group like us would sing, and thinking about how expansive that music could be, both in terms of narrative and sound world, and as David was speaking to, just the palette of vocal color that we're able to access. And so Lorelei is 8 voices. I sometimes sing, I'm the 9th. In this case, I'm conducting, and we are, in this case, 4 sopranos, 2 mezzos, and 2 contraltos. And again, as David says, you know, those are voice types, but each one of those people has a really unique instrument and a really unique way of approaching some of these texts. So I think that, you know, what we've set out to do is not just to be, you know, an excellent group that is doing good music, excellent music that we think is compelling, but also to change expectations about what it is that a women's vocal ensemble can sound like, and what stories we're going to tell, and how we're going to tell them while also preserving our own humanity, our own individuality. And I think this album and this piece allows us to do that in a way that, you know, is subtle, maybe more subtle than some other repertoire that we sing, that really brings folks out in their voices in a more soloistic way. And yet there are these solo moments, there's moments where you really recognize the individual people on the album and their sort of ownership of the music and the text as they deliver it.
Let me just say, it's a fantastic performance. You mentioned, you know, nuance. Earlier you mentioned the difficulties of working in the world of minimalism, for lack of a better term. Now that David is right here, I wonder if you can tell me, what were the big challenges for you in embracing this piece and giving it such a thoughtful, detailed performance?
I mean, I would say maybe one of the misunderstandings about minimalism is that it would be simple. And I think it's, we agree as an ensemble, it's a virtuosic way of delivering text. There's a lot of control and attention to the other sounds in the room that is really unique to this style. And I would say I haven't had a lot of trouble coming to love this music. I think minimalism is where I would live, you know, 99% of the time. I love the feeling of the repetition and the, you know, the slow evolution of a text or a rhythmic or melodic idea. But I think that sometimes for the ensemble, again, as a group that's really championing individual vocal color, there is an amount of that that we have to give over to the anonymity of the story, anonymity of the music at times, that really takes, you know, there's more subtlety there that I think, having sung this piece now since 2016 and other versions of some of the movements, like I Live in Pain, which we sang the three voice version of that first on our first album before we sang this extended piece. And I think that we have evolved with the piece and really come to know the text and know the music well in a way that we can deliver it naturally and feel that, you know, it's really kind of in our bones at this point.
David mentioned he wrote this in part, was inspired to mix the ancient and modern texts because of Anonymous Four. They focus on old music as well as new music. And your group has a similar mix of medieval and Renaissance, and you commission new works. I mean, what is the connection between those two worlds of music?
I mean, a lot of people talk about maybe there's a similarity in the vocal technique that we use to deliver early and new music. I think for me, I'm more interested in the fact that there's a lot of unknown about doing early music. There are a lot of questions to be answered. There are a lot of, you know, dilemmas that we have in interpreting an early score, whether that's notation or that, and really understanding what the intentions of the composer are, or that's really just not knowing the way that it would have been sung. And so there's an amount of artistic decision-making that you do in early music that to me parallels the excitement of working with a living composer, where, you know, you don't have a recording to refer to say, this is how you perform this piece, this is how we expect to hear it. And so then there is that license that I think makes the music making more artistic and really more fulfilling. So for me, that's my draw to the early and the new. I would say Lorelei probably leans on the new side, whereas Anonymous Four would have been leaning more on the early side. And I have to admit that they've done a lot of that work for groups like Lorelei. They've created amazing editions that we've also sung from on previous albums.
David, can you talk a little bit about how you turn this from a quartet into an octet and what the approach there was? I know that the performers also used some percussion instruments here and there. I mean, how did you sort of blow it up, so to speak?
Well, I was very careful that some of the things that I really liked as solos, I wanted to have as solos, so that we would still be able to have a kind of personal relationship with some of the singers. So they come, they sing solos, you hear them, you see them step out from the ensemble, and you feel a connection to them, which is great. But there were moments in the piece that I always felt could actually, you know, have a kind of greater weight if more people were singing them. So this gave me a way of making a larger relief between the things that are, you know, focused and singular and on the surface, and the things that are shared and are deeper. So all I did was, I didn't try to change anything in the original. There are only a few parts where there is like an extra note added or something, but what I really did is I could make the relief between the solo and the ensemble much larger. So so to me, that was really, that was helpful, because then I could sort of sort out the emotions and the experiences which are one person's, and the emotions which are things that maybe a group of people or we all share.
Yeah. Well, it's a wonderful performance. And your music, it should be said, has this sort of timeless quality to it. There's always a feeling of going somewhere but being suspended in space at the same time. I'm sure you've heard this sort of thing before, characterization of your music. How would you characterize your musical approach to these texts? I mean, obviously, many of them are your own translations. Some of them are literal from Lydia Davis, but what was your musical approach?
Well, it's interesting, because when I write vocal music, I feel like I change from being, you know, a composer of something abstract to being the official reader of the text. You know, it's like, here's this text and someone is going to read it to you, right? That's the performance. So all of a sudden I try to cut out everything that's not, you know, that's an ornament or that's extraneous. I really just want you to be able to concentrate on what's the simplest way to understand this text. And when I think about how to you know, pace it and what I want people to do, I really want to be to feel like myself, like I'm in the presence of something that I can think about. So I don't want to have somebody tell me, here's where you get excited and here's where you come down, here's where we all cry and here's where we all laugh. I want to actually just have somebody say, here's this thing, like a book, you know, let's just read it. Let's just think about it. And I'm not going to tell you where the high parts are. And I'm not going to tell you where I'm going to force you to cry, you know, whatever. I'm just going to tell you the truth. And we're all just going to think about it. And then it's going to be presented so we can be thoughtful while we're listening. And hopefully that means we can be thoughtful about it after it's over, when we remember what the experience was like. And we can think about whether or not the music means something to us after the piece is over. So to me, that's the really the key to this, is I don't want to actually tell anybody what to feel. I just want to make you pay a little more attention to what you are feeling while you are listening to it, so it will stay with you.
Yeah, and there seems to be a little bit of a ceremonial aspect to it, which I hear especially in the instruments that you use. Like the second instrumental break sounds like the blowing of the shofar. You know, it grabs your attention. You know, something important is coming, you know, and this is like the explosion of anger, I guess, that is happening. Do you have these little points where you want to draw people's attention to what the text is saying?
Yeah, I definitely am trying to, you know, sculpt a pathway through it, but I'm also trying to, you know, not make it so easy, right? You know, so yeah. Like in a Brechtian sense, you know, the moment when the conch shell blows, it's like, don't get too close, right? I'm not trying to make this like a Hollywood story where you're following the relationship, you know, like, oh, there's a little distance here, right? So to me, I always laugh when I hear that moment, because I always think this is like one of the weirdest things in the piece, and it's so funny, and it's also so sad. And you know, the instruction is you're supposed to blow the conch shell until you can hear yourself run out of gas, right? You know, so you hear this kind of heroic thing that also, I mean, the original idea was that it would be like a post-horn, you know, like something that exists in music history where we see it in old music, and it's like an old sound, an ancient sound, you know, that we hear in front of us and then it fizzles out. So it's supposed to be funny and tragic at the same time.
Well, it caught my attention. I was distracted for a moment, and I heard that, and I went back to the CD player after that.
I'm glad we distracted you.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. I just want to point out, before we let you go, the last song in the piece, Mild and Light, which uh-huh. is very much, you know, the Liebestod, the love death of Isolde at the end of Wagner's opera. It's interesting that you mentioned you sort of started with Wagner in your conception, and then you give him the last word. But it's a very different interpretation of death that you have going on here. It's almost like you're asking a question again at the very end. And your text, your translation, mirrors very closely to what she's talking about, but you have a different sensibility, I think. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I don't think there's anything heroic about what's happening, right? You know, that's any more heroic than what happens in our normal life. You know, here was something beautiful. Did you see it? Did you pay attention to it? How much did it change you? It's just normal life. Did you really pay attention? And you know, so I was just trying to think again back to this idea. You know, we see these lovers in Tristan and Isolde, and we think of them as heroes. You know, we're heroes. We are the heroes. We have to live our lives. You know, we are the subject of art, not these people that we make up in history. You know, it's like we make up people in history to distract us from the fact that we're the heroes. And our heroes are, you know, the heroic thing is being completely normal. And that's the hardest thing to do. And so I really wanted to come back to that at the end of the piece.
It's so interesting. And after talking with you, I need to go back and listen again. So I really appreciate both of your times this morning. I assume everybody's staying safe with the pandemic going on, yeah?
So yeah. Far, so good here.
Yeah.
I haven't left the house in weeks.
But you're a composer. You can do that.
I've been writing music. There's nothing else to do.
Yeah. Well, Beth, I imagine it's had some impact on you and your ensemble.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't look great for ensembles like us in 2020-21. But we are, you know, we have some plans for virtual work and looking forward to developing some projects for down the road. So we'll stay active.
Do you have a website we can send folks to if they want to see your projects and maybe even chip in a little bit and support the arts right now?
That would be fabulous. Our website's loreleiensemble.com, loreleiensemble.com. And any support of what we're doing, even if that's just paying attention to what we're putting out there that's new or checking out some of our previous recordings. But of course, financial support right now means a lot to a group as we navigate our way through this difficult time.
Yeah, it is a difficult time for the arts, definitely. We need all the support we can get. I want to thank you both for joining me today, Beth Willer, Artistic Director and Conductor of the Lorelei Ensemble, and the eminent composer, David Lang. I know, David, I've talked to you before in the past over the phone, but it's so great to actually see you here in person on this Zoom call. So thank you both for your time this morning. The album is Love Fail. It's from Cantaloupe Recordings with the Lorelei Ensemble, conducted by Beth Willer. We'll link to that from our website when we post this. And again, thanks for joining us on FM 91.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Brad. Thank you.